For the past year at St. Matt's, we have been exploring the Old Testament as a library of sacred texts, stories about how God has covenanted with a people, walked with them, cared for them, learned to understand them, and remained faithful to them no matter what. We've been doing this to try and understand the remarkable collection of stories that make us who we are and made Jesus who he was. These stories orient us to our past, to our future, and to our present, and our neighbors in faith, by giving us a sense of the long and varied relationship between our God and the world. This is the last Sunday that we will be with this series, and so we have chosen to end the story with Esther. This is a perfect place to end, perhaps because Esther is a book so unlike all the other books in the Old Testament. You see, as it happened in the days of King Ahasuerus of all of Persia, the same Ahasuerus who ruled 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, as it happened, King Ahasuerus had a banquet and got very drunk. On the seventh day of his banquet, he decided that his queen needed to come to his feast and show herself off. Queen Vashti said no, and so Ahasuerus deposed her, took her crown, and sent out a decree to all of Persia that all wives everywhere needed to honor their husbands, just in case they got any ideas. About a year later, though, Ahasuerus wasn't so mad anymore, and so he remembered that it was kind of nice to have a queen, and so he had his advisors tell him what to do to find a new queen from among all the virgins of the land. Enter all the virgins of the land, including Esther, the niece and adopted daughter of Mordecai, a Jew who has a role in the king's secret police. Esther is taken into the harem and given one whole year of cosmetic treatments so that she can spend just one night with the king, upon which the king will decide whether or not she should be queen. When it is her turn, Esther charms the king with humility and grace, and right then and there, he makes her queen, but she never reveals to him her heritage. Anyway, some other guy named Haman gets promoted, and now he's Mordecai's boss. He's a bit full of himself, and he has decided that everyone needs to bow before him and do obeisance. Mordecai is like, no, I'm not going to do that because I don't bow to mere mortals. This is where we began reading. Haman is so mad about this that he pays Ahasuerus to kill all of Mordecai's people. So Mordecai goes into mourning. He puts on sackcloth and ashes and keens at the citadel gate. Hearing this, Esther reaches out to him through an attendant, and they have this desperate exchange. This is a deeply emotional and serious moment in a text that is otherwise quite exaggerated and comical. For a moment, all the silliness of the dopey king and the hilariously egomaniacal courtier fall away as these two oppressed people try to save their lives and the lives of their kindred. Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for a time such as this. The story doesn't stay serious for very long, though. Esther calls an impossibly long fast, and afterwards she arrays herself in all of her royal robes, and she goes to the king when he is holding court. Ahasuerus seems to be in a good mood that day, and so without drama, Esther invites him to a special banquet. Just him and his very powerful prime minister, Haman. Haman is so blind to his own desire for honor that he revels in the idea that she has invited only him to his special banquet. But on his way to the citadel, he passes Mordecai. Mordecai is still covered in dust and ashes at the gate, and Mordecai annoys him so much that he goes home and summons his whole household, and I quote, recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he alone had been invited to the court of Queen Esther. But none of this meant anything to him, because Mordecai still existed. So, Haman makes a 5-story-tall gallows for Mordecai. 5 stories tall. And then he happily bounces off to Esther's banquet. Once Haman arrives, everyone has had plenty of wine, and Esther makes her move. She reveals to the king that she is a Jew, and that Haman has bought the right to kill her and all her people. Angry and horrified, Ahasuerus stomps out of the room. Haman rushes to Esther to plead for his life, but when the king returns and sees Haman groveling before Esther, he thinks that Haman is making a move on Esther, and so he has him executed immediately on the very gallows that Haman constructed for Mordecai. Mordecai and Esther are honored, and they dramatically reverse the decree that Haman set down, and the book ends with a letter from Esther detailing how this event is always to be honored as the festival of Purim. This is quite a story. Purim has been celebrated among Jewish communities for at least 2,000 years, and they read the whole book through twice, rapidly, while they make lots of noise and try to blot out the name of Haman. And so anything that I say about this book right now is not even going to scratch the surface of all the things that are going on here. This is a confounding book in Hebrew literature, because it's missing a number of the usual plot points that come with the Old Testament. First of all, Esther and Mordecai are not particularly focused on keeping the law, nor do they worry about their diet or any particularly Jewish prayer practices. The Hebrew version of this book never actually uses the name of God. So interpreters, very early on, noticed this, and some communities inserted more stories to make this one conform better. But other rabbis said that Esther is actually a book about how God is at work even when we don't see it happening. The lack of God's name in Esther invites the reader to see how God is between the lines of all things, and how God's salvation can come from more than just dramatic miracles. God's apparent absence instead shows us that God also functions outside our own religious language. This is also a satirical story. It is a comedy about the absurdity of evil. It caricatures evil as ridiculous and drunk and ultimately doomed. But for us, in a world where events like this have actually happened to Jewish people and to plenty of other people, recognizing the comedy in the original text might feel highly problematic for us. So I want to point out 2 different ways that that does important work. In Jewish communities and other communities that experience attempts at annihilation, this comedic rendition of the absurdity of evil is a way of resisting destruction by insisting on enjoying one's identity. Painting evil as absurd is a kind of resistance in and of itself. In Christian communities, and in other communities who have attempted to annihilate, this story serves as a reminder that God is always with the oppressed. Even if miracles are not occurring, even if no voice from heaven shows up and says, "I'm God and I'm here and y'all are wrong," God is still among the suffering, in their courage, in their resistance, in their identities and their vocations, and working for their salvation. And so when we approach the story of Esther, we can see it as an invitation. An invitation to see God where we might have assumed that God was absent. An invitation to God working with the oppressed. And finally, as an invitation into our own unique moments such as these. Each one of us will have a moment or many moments where our particular identities and experiences are exactly what is needed to stand up for what is right. Esther stumbled upon her power, but she chose to take a hold of it. She could have chosen to remain hidden and safe, but she recognized that a life without her true identity, her true self, was no life at all. When we are faced with death, destruction, when we see hate, when we see annihilation, like Esther, we are called upon to speak up and to do something. When those moments come, I pray that we choose the new commandment that Jesus has left with us, that we choose to take up the power of love, that we choose to reveal our true identities as those who love one another and the other. I pray that none of us will be asked to risk our lives or face evil on this scale. But I pray that when the time comes, we will know that we have become exactly who we are for moments such as these. Amen.